It's just as nice to have you in because, obviously, since the last time you were here, and I believe this was the book about Ethiopia, where you were here before, obviously you haven't been resting on your laurels, so you've been busy and, indeed, in reading some of the publicity material you've been teaching. So just give me a fill-in about what's been happening to you.
Well, I thought that it would be nice in my declining years to take a job that was offered me at University of California, Irvine, in their writing program, the graduate writing program out there, which seems to be a pretty good one. It's rated very highly, of course, but it seems to produce a lot of professional writers who get their novels published and so on. They take in only 6 kids every year from all over America, and there's a workshop of 12. So I took that job, but just before I took it, we formed in Australia a little group called the Australian Republican Movement, whose aim was to do away with the last constitutional ties with Britain and, of course, with the monarchy. And we thought that we'd be beaten over the head, sent underground very quickly, and would spend our time occasionally writing something, talking to politicians, talking to pollsters. In fact, the story, the debate rather, never went away from 1991 onwards. And here in 1993, we're on the verge of becoming a republic by peaceful means.
Well, what does that mean exactly as compared, of course, Australia is a Commonwealth nation with a certain allegiance to London, to Buckingham Palace.
Well, certainly. I mean, we're still supposed to take oaths when we take offices and so on, oaths to the Queen of Great Britain. She is by legal fiction Queen of Australia, but no one ever says, there goes the Queen of Australia. And indeed, she has very little values in common with the predominant Australian values. What it means is that we have a head of state who can't speak for us because she's speaking for Westminster. She's speaking for a Britain which is stitched into Europe, into a trade bloc from which we are excluded. So we have the ridiculous situation where our own head of state is making arrangements under the instructions, without any malice, under the instructions of the British government, arrangements which are prejudicial to us. And the zone we are allowed to operate in, Southeast Asia and the Pacific zone, the zone of promise for us in diplomatic, commercial, cultural and other terms, thinks it's pretty ridiculous that our primary icon of statehood is a perfectly nice English grandmother who is located 12,000 miles off our shore.
Well, in terms of sheer practical politics, how will there be a governmental change?
There will have to be a referendum.
When will that be?
And we're working up to the referendum now. There can't be a referendum to change it, and I think a lot of politicians want to change it, but some of them haven't been able to say so up to now.
Well, this referendum would be non-binding. It would be a recommendation among the voters.
Oh, no, it is binding.
It would be binding.
And our only problem is we have to get a majority of Australians in favour, but also a majority of the states in favour. And therefore, we need to persuade the more conservative politicians, and that process is hugely underway now. In the last couple of days, they've all said it's got to be debated, by which they mean the republic has to be confronted, and many of them have said that a republic is inevitable, so that there are cartoons in Britain as we speak of poor E2R, Elizabeth II, saying three words I don't want to hear, Fergie, die, and Australia. Of course, we're not moved by any rancor towards her. If we feel any rancor, it's against ourselves for playing at this game of cultural dependence for so long, pretending that the only thing that saves our squalid little convict institutions down there in the Southwest Pacific is this holy alliance from far across oceans and continents.
But in governmental terms, Australia is a democracy. What changes would there be?
Well, we would have our own head of state directly or indirectly elected. He or she would not be like an American president. They wouldn't have executive powers. But they would have some crucial powers based on our parliamentary system, like the power to tell a prime minister who has lost the support of the House that he must resign.
So there would still be a parliamentary system with the prime minister.
There would be a parliamentary system with a prime minister and a senate and so on.
Well, that's hardly any change at all, except that there's some philosophic allegiance has been dismembered.
An enormous, I agree with you, not a big structural change, but a change which reflects the reality of our situation in the world, the reality of geopolitics now, the sad fact in the mind of many older Australians that the British Empire no longer exists, either as a trade or in any a trade community or in any other form of community. And a very important message to ourselves and to the world, because if we are in Southeast Asia, as we largely are now, and we're trying to do business, and we're trying to do our own peculiar but not unbeneficent sort of diplomacy, we've been doing it all under the aegis of this institution, the British monarchy, and this makes us seem inevitably the last of the Gilbertian colonies in Southeast Asia. And, of course, it sends a signal that we are arrantly European to the extent that we would prefer to be moored off Kent. Sadly, we're stuck down with 200 million Indonesians, and I say sadly, that in the minds of many older Australians, it is a matter of sadness that we're not closer to the mother country geographically. But the reality is that we have to deal with being an Asian neighbour. We are not Asia, we're Australia, but we have to deal with being a neighbour in Asia. And if we wish to do that, to sail under the banner of the Queen of Great Britain is to appear fatuous and lacking in seriousness and maturity. And so you're quite right, it's not a great structural change, but it is a very important psychological change for us and a very important signal to our region.
And yet, in your novel, Woman of the Inner Sea, there are so many English idioms reflected, words that we don't use in America. For example, you would say bonnet for hood or lift for elevator.
Yes,
there are a whole bunch of them in there. Of course, I know exactly what they are. There's no confusion. But but I can see the English orientation in your writing. You didn't have to do that. But unless of course, this does indeed reflect Australia's philosophical ties with England.
I think that until about 1950, the predominant derivation of our immigrants was from working-class England, the north of England, Geordies, West Country people, Cockneys, Scots, Irish, Welsh. And inevitably, we brought these immigrants brought British idiom with them, as indeed they did to you. I don't know if I was discussing with you. I wrote a book about 18th century convicts, and they spoke a convict cant talk, which was full of terms which are now American, like pal. Pal was a pickpocket's accomplice. Fence. Fence was mm-hmm. someone knew, well, exactly what it means now, it meant then, terms like pig for a peace officer. So, you know, in American English, too, there are elements which we think of as purely American, which in fact are old idioms of English,
right,
which have become
many
localized.
Many of them are Elizabethan that have become stuck in the hills of America and have caught in, sure.
And so we've got the same thing. I mean, you find idioms in there which are purely Australian and derived from, certainly wouldn't be heard in modern English.
Well, there's one phrase that keeps popping up, and I'm not even sure how to pronounce it, but I know it's a curse word. It's globshite, I think it is. Is that right?
Oh, globshite. Yeah, well, Frank.
Oh, globshite.
Yes.
Globshite.
Gob.
Gobshite.
Yes, this is someone who speaks nonsense, you know. And it's Uncle Frank. Kate has a defrocked uncle who's an Irish priest called the not-so-reverend Frank O'Brien. And actually, gobshite is an Irish term. It's not Australian, and it's a slightly cleaned-up version of something immensely more profane, but virtually gob means mouth, and and the rest of it I leave to your imagination.
I had never heard that term before.
And
that was a new one on me.
It's purely an Irish one, that one. But the use of the word reckon is very common in Australia, and probably in parts of the South here.
Mm-hmm.
Australians say all the time, I reckon we ought to do this,
right.
Or I reckon he's not going to be too happy when we get back to the office. I reckon this, I reckon that. And I think that's an old English, probably 18th century usage. There's a lot of Cockney slang in Australia, rhyming slang. My father, for example, calls sharks Noahs, N-O-A-H-S. Now, the reason he does that is because shark rhymes with Noah's Ark. Then the Australians have taken Cockney rhyming slang one step further. They've knocked off the rhyming word, and they use just Noah's to mean sharks. The Ark goes unsaid, but it still rhymes with shark. And so sharks are Noah's. If you're on your pat, you're on your own. Pat Malone rhymes with own. But they knock the Malone part off, and you're supposed to interpret this missing word and rhyme it with on your own and know what they're talking about.
Let me interject something. You mentioned that these Cockney phrases. Why do you suppose New Zealand and Australia have retained elements of a Cockney dialect, where in Canada and the United States it's been lost?
Yes.
Because the people were the same. I mean, I think my ancestry goes back to indentured servants from England.
I think it's partly because rhyming slang was probably a 19th century, early 20th century thing. And that's when most of our immigration occurred, whereas yours was much earlier to the United States. The elements of your language were laid down. They kept on being laid down, and, you know, Jewish immigrants brought more usages and so on. But the basic elements were laid down earlier than ours were. And I think the Cockney... A Cockney idiom was more dominant in Australia, perhaps from the start, because a lot of convicts came from the Cockney East London, Cockney areas of London, and a lot of convicts were Cockneys. They were either very fly East Londoners, or they were immensely more innocent first offenders from the countryside, and therefore believe that Cockney idiom was laid down in Australia and arrived on the convict ships. If you look at the very first fleet that went to Australia, it was made up of, say, just short of 800 convicts. And you would find that half of those came from London and were habitual crims, the like, I mean, you could call them that. They were not unlike, actually, the people from, say, the L.A. ghettos. They were people of great promise, but they were alienated, and the only profession open to them was crime. And they were very, very fine at their profession, and they had a whole ethos of criminality. And,
yeah, but from what I've read Robert Hughes's book about the settling in Australia, and England just went overboard in sentencing people for nothing, children and for stealing apples. They would be packed on a prison ship. I mean, that's absurd.
I have a book called The Playmaker that was published here by Simon & Schuster some years ago, and it was turned into a very successful play by the Royal Court Theatre. It was on in the Needle and the Theatre for a time. It was called Our Country's Good. And it's about a group of convicts putting on the first play in Australia in 1789, the year of the French Revolution. Virtually as the tennis court oath is being taken, these young detritus of the young garbage of British prisons is staging this great European ritual of the play in the 18th century equivalent of Mars, Australia. And they were very young. The playmaker, the play director, is a young British officer called Ralph Clark, who actually existed and left a journal, and it's quite a magnificently neurotic journal. But he fell in love with a young woman called Mary Brenham, who was sentenced to death at the age of not yet 14, the court records say. And she was then reprieved as being too young for the gallows, particularly as a woman. And she was transported to Australia for 7 years. Of course, could never return. It was like being transported to Alpha Centauri for 7 years. You know, you can't get back. You can never get the spaceship back. And she fell in love with Ralph Clark, or he with her, and she had a child by him. But she was sentenced at the Old Bailey when not yet 14 for the theft of clothes. It was not abnormal for people of 13, 14, 15, 17 to be sentenced. And in the First Fleet there was a young man called John Hudson, who was first sentenced when he was 9 and was then sentenced again at the age of 11, condemned to death, reprieved, transported to Australia. So he was transported when he was still 11. He's put on the convict ships at Portsmouth and shipped that improbable distance. And so it goes. Most of the majority of the convicts were really quite young, because conditions are like, were in the late 18th century like they are now. Society didn't have, if I dare say so, too many equities attached to it. And therefore, there was a huge alienated underclass from which the original settlers of Australia came. And the jailers were more or less of the same class too. The way the underclass is now, the most dangerous members of the underclass are often very young.
Well, there is kind of an underclass in Women of the Sea, but these are white-collar criminals.
Oh, yes, that's the other thing Sydney is great in. Like New York, I suppose, white-collar crime. Kate marries the son of a Polish immigrant who arrived in Sydney and built up this enormous construction company out of a wheelbarrow, built it up from a wheelbarrow. In 20 or 30 years, they've got malls in California and throughout Australia and so on. And she marries him and has two children in this idyllic but very venal city, which Sydney has always been. It's an unabashedly corrupt city. Not in the sense that you're going to be mugged or set upon by footpads, but at the highest level, there's a lot of dealing going on, and the building industry is very corrupt. It involves a lot of standover tactics, a lot of shonky tendering and so on. And then Sydney's always been a place where there's a lot of gambling, legal and illegal, and a considerable amount of prostitution.
Well, you have put your novels all over the world, in every conceivable place. But you go back to Australia for that, and it's nice, because here a reader can have a feeling of contemporary Australia.
Yes, it's great beauty. I mean, I do hasten to say, since we're anxious for American tourists, that this venal side of Sydney is something you're aware of only if you live there. It's an extremely safe and extremely spick-and-span sort of city. And after I went home last January to take up the Republican fight again, I was astonished by the purity of the surf, the clarity of the water, magnificent surf beaches.
Of course, you live on the beach, don't you?
Live on the beach. Just from the bottom of the garden, you go down a track for about 30 metres, and then you're on this beautiful little beach called Bilgola.
The nudist end of the beach.
You remember that I told you that years ago. That's right. There used to be a statute in Sydney that you could be topless at one end of the beach, and our end was the topless end. And the other, I mean, toplessness has simply spread to an extent that I think most Americans would find shocking, you know.
Well, our New York State Court of Appeals has ruled that it is legal, but of course that gets everybody excited, so little individual communities get all up in arms, and the sort of, you theoretically, and the ruling is just crazy. It says a woman can go topless even walking down Fifth Avenue, provided she doesn't not do it in a licentious way, so she doesn't attract any sexual there's no sexual overtones.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Isn't that silly? I mean, sure, they can go topless, but don't make it sexy.
Well, it's hard for older men who were raised in the days where the breast was a forbidden fetish, you know.
Well, we're Victorians at heart here,
yes,
you know.
Yeah.
And I have a feeling that there's some of it, perhaps a little less, in Australia.
Well, I think there's a strong streak. It's not quite the robust Puritanism which is still at the heart of American society. For example, I don't think, with all due respect, that we'd spend an entire federal election discussing whether someone had inhaled or not, or had once known what was she, a singer-dancer?
That's right. Well, I think Mr. Clinton's opponents were desperate, so they jumped on anything they could find,
yes,
to discredit Clinton.
But extraordinary, more mileage in those silly things here. We have our own silly things in which we endow mileage, but they're not generally matters to do with personal morality, unless it's the sort of personal immorality which frightens the horses and is obviously malign. I don't think, for example, a politician who was a paederast or a child abuser could be elected. And in fact, I'm sure they couldn't. But we've had prime ministers who were admitted adulterers, admitted reformed alcoholics, like Bob Hawke, who was prime mm-hmm. minister for 10 years.
Well, it should be noted that obviously the campaign did not work against Mr. Clinton, and they felt that he offered a great alternative, no matter what his personal background was. It just wasn't that important.
Yes, it does give you hope in the system.
And I personally don't care if he impregnated half the state of Arkansas. His sexual life is really not that important. It's how he leads a nation.
Yes, indeed. Of course, Franklin Delano Roosevelt had a mistress to whom he was very attached, and No one mentioned it.
Not during those days. But let's get back to Women of the Inner Sea. This is a book that's got so much drama in it, and this great flood scene where Kate goes to this little town where she goes to work as a barmaid in a tavern. I mean, you have a lot of sweep to this book, and you say an awful lot about Australia in a variety of ways. You have a character, I believe his name is Gus, who rescues Australia's national figurines, so to speak.
Kangaroo and the emu.
That's correct. And so, I mean, this is a purely Australian book, isn't it?
Yes, and it's somewhat, it grows to be somewhat magical once the... What happens is that Kate is a wealthy young woman married to the young developer and construction man, and she becomes an ideal mother, probably to a slightly malign degree, if that's possible. And then we find that living on the northern beaches of Sydney, this ideal with her perfect children, is utterly borne away by terrible events that are too terrible to mention for most of the book. In fact, they're only mentioned at the end, and or towards the end. And, you know, I assure the reader, I think, in the course of the book, that this isn't done for cheap suspense. It's too serious.
Well, I tell you, you got me a little confused, because you at the point where Kate is heading home with her father after this, after we know something bad has happened, your next chapter says, and then 3 months later, she's in the hospital. And I said, wait a minute, I missed something here. I've got to go back and find it out. And I began to try to piece things together. And I just wasn't sure. I mean, it took a long time. Then I said, look, Tom is telling the story. Just let me read it, and I'm sure this will unfold. But at first, I thought I had missed something.
Yes, sure. Maybe there should have been a bit of connective tissue there, Don.
No, by the end of it, everything is put together, so I don't know that that's necessary.
Yes, she goes to the bush, mm-hmm. and she tries to become a different woman.
I was a little confused about one thing, and that was Kate's burns, because at first I thought, obviously the children must have died in a fire, and maybe Kate rushed into the burning building to try to rescue the kids or something, that then got the burn. And so I was confused about that. And then she goes to Fiji, and where she becomes ill and gets sunstroke. And I figured she must have got the burns there. So I'm still a little, it's a little vague in my mind. Am I correct?
She gets badly sunburned.
Enough to cause all the scarring?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This would actually cause all that scarring?
Yes. Oh, that sun. Yes, indeed. I mean... It is, that piece is based on a real case.
I'm sure most of this is based on real cases, isn't it?
Well, a young woman told me a story 10 years ago about losing her children and then setting out to become a different sort of person, and a woman who hadn't lost her children. And I've been wanting to write about it for 10 years, changing her geographical location, changing the sort of work she does, changing her mode of life, utterly changing the sort of food she eats, you know, giving up the refined diet of the city and becoming a bush woman who eats steak twice a day and bacon for breakfast and eggs with everything and white bread with butter. And she's trying to change herself cell by cell through this method. So it's heavily fictionalized. It's removed, that initial anecdote has been removed to Australia. But she goes on her odyssey to the inner sea, the part of Australia which used to once be a sea, and where Europeans used to expect there to be a sea, used to expect to find a sea. And She's very dependent upon this talismanic familiar kangaroo that travels round with her and Gus, because when she sleeps, she has this dream of kangaroo bounding, and in her dream she experiences an ecstasy that she can't let herself experience when she's awake. And she becomes so dependent upon this, she becomes so dependent upon the kangaroo dreaming and upon the kangaroo Chifley, whom Gus has rescued from this entertainment park, where it has been one of the living elements in a tableau vivant of the Australian coat of arms. She becomes so dependent on the kangaroo dreaming for her joy in life that, of course, the idea of ever losing Chifley becomes a cataclysmic potentiality to her. So all that, of course, was not in the original anecdote I heard years ago, and the heavy layers of fictionalizing that have gone in there. I wanted to set it in Australia, the tale, because I've always been fascinated by the contrast between Sydney and the bush, which is greater now than it was when I was a kid, you know. Sydney was beautiful, but it was relatively dour when I was a kid. It was very British Isles working class sort of society, you know, and it was people ate at six, and the pubs even in those days closed at six, and then life began the next morning when the alarm clock went. And even then there was a big contrast between Sydney and the bush, but it's greater now because Sydney has become much more cosmopolitan.
This would be a terrific movie, actually. It's got so much drama and sweep to it. Speaking of movies, what about this controversy regarding Schindler's List, where they didn't want Spielberg to film in the concentration camp?
That's right. Spielberg wanted to film part of Schindler's List in Auschwitz, Birkenau, the main camp, the part of it which still stands, and which is quite immense, and still has the railroad gate going through it, through which all those people traveled to their deaths. And he first, I think, he may have wanted to build something in there, a few things, and then he said, oh, no, all right, I just want to do 4 days filming there. And the Polish government gave him permission to do that. I'm sure he had the best of motives in wanting to film in Auschwitz, but people were uneasy about filming a commercial movie there. But in any case, he got permission for 4 days filming, and then the World Jewish Congress made their appeal to the Polish government, and they said no filming at all. And so that, as far as I know, that held him up some days, but the film has begun shooting now.
Did you have any role in the film, other than, of course, creating the book that
spawned
the movie?
After doing this little book tour, I'm going to, this is an indication of the ridiculous life I lead, going to Eritrea in the Horn of Africa for the Eritrean referendum. They eventually got, you know, they beat the tyrant, Mengistu. Jimmy Carter tried to intervene in all that, but Mengistu was a Stalinist monster of the first order and would not play along with the settlement. So he's now fallen, and the Eritreans are about to have their referendum for independence. So I'm going there, and from there, I'm going up to Frankfurt by some terrible series of African planes. Great pilots in Africa, but African countries can't afford quite the scale of maintenance that prevails in the West. And then up to Poland, to Krakow, to watch 3 or 4 days of the filming. And that will be a nice experience. I mean, there are a lot of Schindler sites still there in Poland. His old factory in Krakow, in a place called Zabloci, across the Vistula River, the site of his first camp, it's still there. It's a telephone components factory now. Likewise, the apartment in which he lived, the ghetto is still intact. Krakow was captured by the Russians, and it doesn't seem to have been pretty quickly. It doesn't seem to have been subjected to any of the desolation that that Warsaw was subjected to. So, and then, of course, on the hill, there's this great castle and cathedral called the Wawel Castle, which was Frank, the German governor general of Poland. That was his headquarters. And so there's a lot there.
Does it make you nervous to think about somebody else filming your book? I mean, sitting down there in the theater and looking at, in effect, your words transcribed to the screen.
About it. You know, it's a child that's gone out and married some questionable bloke, a filmmaker. You don't know if it's all going to work out, but you hope it does.
Of course, got Spielberg there. That's a pretty good endorsement.
Last year, he had a severe bout of flu. During it, he reread the book. He's had the rights for 10 years and underlined everything in it that he wanted in the screenplay. He was, at that stage, vaguely dissatisfied with the screenplay as it then existed. And he got all this typed up and said, this is what has to be in the film. That is a little over a year ago now. And he, of course, wants to make a good film. He does show a very strong sense of the paradoxes of the personality of Schindler, the scoundrel savior. But he is nervous about it because he has less than a happy relationship with critics. But, I mean, the material is wonderful material for someone to work on who wants to expiate with the critics, having made E.T. and Back to the Future and so on. And I think he has honourable intentions towards the thing. And Liam Neeson playing Schindler, and that's an interesting choice, an Irish lad.
Well, Tom Keneally, we could go on speaking forever. I have a feeling our tape has run out, and we have other appointments, but I'm sure we could spend the rest of the afternoon chatting. It's great seeing you again, and Woman of the Inner Sea, it's a beautiful book. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.